Welcome, everyone, to Esoterics Podcast. You can't eat the sunshine. This is episode 135 for the week of May 4th, 2020. My wife, Kim Cooper, and I are going to interview John Giroto, a longtime Hollywood preservation activist. So, John, could you please properly introduce yourself?
I certainly will. I'm so glad to be here. Thank you for providing an opportunity for me to share anything that you think is important about the preservation scene in Hollywood. Basically, I was providing strategic leadership for preservation for Hollywood Heritage from 2011 to 2018, also working in the neighborhood councils, all four of the neighborhood councils in Hollywood. And generally just trying to make a difference in activism.
Perfect. Okay, great. Kim, do you have anything you'd like to say as we start this?
Well, I would like to say that having John here on the air is so important right now because Hollywood is absolutely 100% our biggest preservation concern, not because there aren't preservation issues all over Los Angeles. There certainly are. But Hollywood has been subject to such extraordinary hyperdevelopment. And it began under Eric Garcetti, who is such a powerful person that he's now been tapped as one of the four little kings in the Joe Biden pre-administration. And he has helped to steer all sorts of development money that was supposed to go to poor parts of Los Angeles into Hollywood. He handpicked his deputy, Mitch O'Farrell, to become his successor. And Hollywood, although you don't hear about Hollywood being part of the FBI investigation into land use and corruption and development in LA, it is such a ground zero for development. I think it's inevitable that we are going to start to hear about it. And so many of these projects, you know, some say the fix is in. They've got very expensive attorneys. They've got zillions of dollars to be made. And then you have these scrappy preservationists of whom we think you are one of the best, just doing the right thing, staying up all night, writing these rebuttals, figuring out the law, and desperately trying to save the culture of my hometown. I grew up in Hollywood, so I thank you, and I'm glad you're here.
Perfect. Okay, before we start, Kim, I need you to give us a God's eye view of Los Angeles in week seven of Mayor Eric Garcetti, a straighter, younger version of Pete Buttigieg, his week seven of his Safer at Home directive. Just God's eye view.
Boy, oh boy, everybody stay at home. Not. I've never seen such extraordinary activism on the streets of Los Angeles. There are rent strikes. There are driving protests. There are marching protests. As we're recording this, there are actually mariachis marching in front of the mayor's home and demanding that their rents be halted because, you know, in their district, they have no representation. Jose Huizar got raided by the FBI, God, almost a year and a half ago, and he hasn't, you know, he never did anything for the mariachis before that unless it was a photo op, and he's certainly not doing anything for them now. And people are, you know, desperately trying to stay alive and looking after each other. There's been a lot of fundraising and community activism to organize and to help people with food and with knowledge. It isn't really focused on the preservation issues yet because it's a matter of life and death. But I think that what's going to come into focus as we figure out what life is going to look like, as many of us cannot go back to work and, you know, we're out of work and many others are as well, what it's going to look like to basically have enough money to live on that comes from the government or something. And you get to think about what world you want to live in. And I'm really inspired by what we're seeing. I think that the election that's coming up in Los Angeles is going to be the most interesting election we've ever seen. It's got nothing to do with who runs for president. It has to do with toppling over a few of the really rotten people who've been destroying the city. And in the meantime, every time we watch a city council meeting, these virtual meetings, they're fighting with each other and they're trying to prove that they're either representing the man or they're representing the people. And I know a few of them are going to get plucked off and sent to prison, but at the end of it, we're going to have to reshuffle the deck and do some counting. It's exciting. I've never been so hopeful for Los Angeles, even though people are suffering terribly. Does that make me weird?
Amen. No,
it's just who I am.
You're perfect.
Okay.
And I love you.
I love you too.
And more on that.
Yeah.
Okay, John Girota, roll up your sleeves. Are you ready?
I Hollywood. Sure am.
Okay, so we talked about this. We both have our talking points in front of us. So I want to hopscotch around Hollywood. I want to spend the majority of our time at the intersection of. You took my notes, Kim.
No, those are mine. Oh, you want this one? Okay. Hey, man. Come on.
You took my notes.
Yeah, okay. But okay. Yeah, you're right. I did.
I want to hopscotch around Hollywood, along Hollywood Boulevard and Sunset Boulevard, but I want to end up at the intersection of Yucca and Argyle.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and that's where I want to do our heavy lifting. So let's Excellent. Work our way towards that. Let's start Hollywood Boulevard and Los Palmas. Okay, there are two entities I want to talk about there, the Larry Edmonds Bookshop and the Egyptian Theater. Okay, so Kim, maybe
more or less, yeah,
more,
pretty close,
within a block of each other. So Kim, why don't you start with the Egyptian Theater?
Oh, okay, sure. So we have the weirdest experience. You know, we don't go to the movies. We just work all the time, and we read old newspapers, and you know, look at photos from the archives, and occasionally, you know, maybe we'll watch a movie on TV like once a year or something.
McCabe and Mrs. Miller.
Well, yeah,
is
we'll watch McCabe and Mrs.
The
Miller.
One film my wife and I can agree upon really loving. Robert Altman's McCabe
Barry
and Mrs. Miller.
Barry
and
Lyndon.
Barry Lyndon by Stanley Kubrick.
Yeah, I mean, we'll watch those. But in a lonely place. That's not the point. The point is, we started getting calls that something really shady was happening at the Egyptian Theater at the American Cinematheque nonprofit. And these were calls from people who were like, I know something, but I can't say anything because I'm really scared. And you guys are so brave and you're never scared to take on City Hall. And we're like, yeah, well, we could tell you things that happen when we take on City Hall that are not so great. And maybe one day we'll tell you that. But what's going on? And what we heard was that it was just a sketchy nonprofit that had run itself into very dire straits and was actually none of the many members who support the American Cinematheque were aware of this, but they were like in trouble with the Attorney General of the state of California because they didn't do their taxes. They didn't report their money, even though they were collecting people's money every year. And they had a board who were checked out, with the exception of a couple of people, one of whom is a very high-ranking Netflix executive, Ted Sarandos. And apparently a decision had been made, maybe at a board meeting, maybe at a cigar bar, that, oh, the American Cinematheque is just too far gone, so we're just going to let Netflix buy it. And that's pretty much the done deal that we were told about when no one knew.
Okay, perfect. So, Kim, we could talk about this for 45 minutes, but we have, like, 2 minutes.
Oh, I don't want to.
So I want to take a breath, and I want to ask you. So Ted Sarandos, the Netflix executive who's on the board of the American Cinematheque, basically said Netflix needs the American Cinematheque, the only repertory movie theater in Hollywood, which was given to the American Cinematheque nonprofit by the Community Redevelopment Agency of Los Angeles after it was purchased and then significantly retrofitted after the Northridge quake. We need it because we need to screen films to be eligible for Academy nomination. And one day ago, the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences nullified our entire 9-month-long campaign to save the American Cinematheque's Egyptian Theater, which I find absolutely fascinating. And what just happened, Kim, with that?
They said, oh, you know, everybody's streaming new movies, and that's fine. We're actually going to waive that rule that you have to show a movie in Los Angeles for a week for it to be eligible for an Oscar. So this is potentially the death
knell for
movie theaters.
That's the first time in, wait a minute, let me hold on, hold the phone, podcast. this is official. I have not heard this.
It came from the Academy.
The Academy of Motion Pictures, Arts and Sciences is waiving the rules requiring a film to be in an Academy-approved theater venue shown for 1 week in Los Angeles.
Like, yes. If this troll movie really needs its Oscar, I don't know. I mean, they could have taken a year off, for God's sake. We are in a global pandemic. But that was the decision that was made. And I guess we'll just see what happens, you know, because everybody said in the press, oh, it's a done deal. Sometimes the trades reported that, you know, the Cinematheque had already sold the theater to Netflix. That hasn't happened. As far as we know, it is still in the hands of the Attorney General, who can make decisions about charity and the properties that they hold. So we'll just see what happens.
And Kim, when did this all really start happening? Hasn't it been over a year?
Yeah, just over like about 13 months.
Okay, right.
So, sometimes the best thing for all of these problems is a little bit of sunlight. It's a wonderful disinfectant because people start lifting their heads up and going, wait a minute. And I think that people are still frightened. I don't know what the situation is with the folks who work at the American Cinematheque. They're doing some live streaming. I don't know if anyone still has a job there. But it's a really important public resource, and it's so much bigger than the small handful of people who've had jobs there for 20 some years. It actually belongs, well, to you, John.
Right.
So I don't want to see it go away because you moved to Hollywood so that you would have access to this. You're a member, or you were, and it belongs to you. It doesn't belong to them.
So, John, I want you to wrap up the American Cinematheque's Egyptian Theater and this whole rich pageant that has been going on for over a year. Why is the American Cinematheque Egyptian Theater important to you as a resident of Hollywood?
Oh wow! The reason I asked how long this has been going on is because so many people have been investing so much of their heart and passion into trying to get some transparency about what's been going on with the Egyptian. But what I will add is during this pandemic, which we're not understanding and how it's going to affect the fate of the Egyptian, is development and construction are considered essential services. So in Hollywood, all the development projects are still going on. And there is a project that was recently entitled for the Egyptian Theater, and it covers the parking lot behind the Egyptian. It will go on top of the historic storefronts that are along there that included Baroque books. And so it's kind of a development that's going to be squeezed in right on top of those stores and then adjacent to the Egyptian and also affect the Egyptian's back access way. So all that's going on, and I don't know how we're going to have public hearings about that. And I know that wasn't specifically what you were talking about with the Egyptian and Netflix and the state of our American Cinematheque, but that does affect the American
Yes.
Cinematheque. And so I'm just. That's my concern is there's still development going on, and development affects businesses or nonprofits like the American Cinematheque.
Perfect. I want you to just talk about, as an abstraction, the value of a loading zone for the backstage for theaters in Hollywood in general. That the American Cinematheque is an instance of this, but this abstraction is very important for the life of theaters in Hollywood in general.
Everybody has to deal with a problem of outdated loading docks, backloading areas. Every single theater on Hollywood Boulevard has had to deal with this. Even the Pantages reached out to Hollywood Heritage over a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, wanting to stage their trucks in the county's parking lot in front of the Hollywood Heritage Museum because they
Right.
have all kinds of restrictions in how they can stage productions and access their back doorway. Just most recently with the Fonda Theater on Hollywood
Right.
Boulevard, there's a new construction development on its southeastern side of the Fonda, and that new development is going to take away the alleyway or access way to the back of the house of the Fonda Theater. And so the Fonda Theater ownership was in kind of a development battle with the developer for over a year, and I think they have resolved their issues. But that's just to say that our older theaters, their access ways, their backstage access ways are very important to modernize. Part of the Palladium's development, if it ever happens, was to include a redevelopment of the backstage door access so that they can bring productions into the 21st century.
Perfect.
We're in
Thank
the
you so
21st century.
much.
Thank you.
I know you are. All right, good. Okay. So, Kim, I want to move down the street to the Larry Edmonds bookshop.
Oh, I hope so. I love
Okay.
going to bookstores.
I know you do.
Even virtually. And you can go virtually. Because now he's selling books on the internet. It's wonderful. 21st century.
Kim, the Larry Edmonds bookshop is at Cherokee in Hollywood, just one block to the east of the Egyptian Theater, which is at Las Palmas and Hollywood Boulevard. Larry Edmonds Bookshop is a very important GoFundMe campaign. GoFundMe campaigns we're going to talk about a bit today. So why don't you get us started on the Larry Edmonds GoFundMe campaign?
Okay, well, Jeff Mantor, who's been running the Larry Edmonds Bookshop for a number of years and you know, came there as a young stock boy who wanted to play rock and roll guitar in Hollywood and needed a job and wanted to live in the neighborhood. He owns the place now, and he's been struggling, as so many of our small businesses are, because when non-essential businesses were shut down, you know, you still got to pay your Hollywood Boulevard rent, but it's real hard. And so Jeff called us and asked what we thought about a GoFundMe campaign. And obviously we said, yeah, you got to do it. And we helped with a little editing to make the ask a little more explicit, because he's so proud and he wasn't comfortable asking for help. And I think it ended up being a really good GoFundMe because it's very honest. It's very frank. It talks about, you know, sort of the way that we said that the Egyptian theater at the American Cinematheque at the Egyptian belongs to you as a community member. He said, you know, I'm just the caretaker of this 80-some-year-old bookstore. I want to keep it around. And if I let it die through no fault of its own because of my pride, I wouldn't be doing a service for any of you. So he put out the cup, and it came back with a great deal of love and help. And he's still obviously campaigning, and he's making an effort to raise more money, to do more virtually while his store is closed, and to give this bookstore a chance to really shine. It's been a wonderful community amenity under his watch. He's done a lot of events all over town. He's really the go-to person when someone from Hollywood who has a book wants to give a talk and do a book signing, and he goes and he, you know, sells books at films, and he's a wonderful, wonderful resource, and the store is amazing. People come from all over the world, and he wisely launched the campaign the week of the TCM Film Festival that did not happen this year at the Egyptian Theater, and gave everyone an opportunity to say, well, you know, if I'd been there, I would have been supporting the Larry Edmonds Bookshop, so I'm going to do it from wherever I am and feel like a little bit of that Hollywood stardust is in my pocket and coming through the mail. And that's what's going on.
Perfect.
But you know,
okay.
You know, Kim, it's neighborhood serving Hollywood stardust. Because when I moved here in 2011, that Larry Edmonds bookstore, it's like the Egyptian. It's one of the things you can stroll down onto Hollywood Boulevard and really experience. What did I discover when I strolled down to Hollywood Boulevard? Sammy Davis Jr.'s daughter was giving a book talk inside Larry Edmonds. There were 6 people inside. I got to have an intimate experience with Sammy Davis Jr.'s daughter explaining the life of her father. And that's only something that happens at Larry Edmonds.
Perfect. Okay, we're going to hold GoFundMe campaigns. We're going to hold that thought for a couple minutes. This is a really good one, and then we're going to turn to really bad ones. So, John, continuing to walk east on Hollywood Boulevard, one more block east, I want to get to Hollywood and Wilcox to the Art Deco Atty building, which has that famous mural of immediate post-war movie stars, and I guess a couple pre-war movie stars in a movie theater. Sort of
You Are the Star is the name of the mural.
Thank you. John, tell us about the Hollywood Wilcox project and the beautiful Art Deco Atty building at Hollywood and Wilcox.
So the reason that the project is called Hollywood and Wilcox Project is it will take up the southeast corner of Hollywood Boulevard and Wilcox Avenue. Currently located the Atty building, maybe people know it as Playmates. That's the sign.
Well, I sure do. Thank you.
But yes, on the facade of the Wilcox side of the building is the You Are the Star mural, which was featured in the Ryan Gosling film, La La Land. Yes. That's where she goes into the club for our younger listeners. But anyways, so the project is done by a developer called Lefrak. And from what I heard about them, they're big in New York and I guess Miami, but they don't always have a great reputation. They were previously in Hollywood circa around 2015 when they tried to build towers at the Mosaic Church, which is the La Brea and Hollywood Boulevard, which is the 5th Church of Christian Science.
Wait. You mean the project where the guy who was in charge of janitorial services somehow got access to the deed and illegally sold the property out from under the parishioners?
Why, that's you're so amazing. That's why you're you who you are. Anyways, Lefrak has left. So the Grotesque project that was going to replace the mid-century modern Fifth Church of Christian Science at the corner of Hollywood and La Brea, the entitlements ran out.
Right.
Now, Lefrak has always had this other project at Hollywood and Wilcox, but they have re-upped it's it re-energized it. It's been around since I first was reviewing it back in 2016 or so. So it will include the retention of the Addy Building and rehabilitation of the Addy Building to its 1938 appearance, which is the Art Deco appearance. It was originally a Bank of Italy. It's been around a long time. I think the original construction date is 1923 for the structure, and it was continually modified throughout the years.
Well,
There's a
the Art Deco panels are extraordinary. I wouldn't want to
Yes, it's
lose
a
them for
great.
anything.
So there's not a fight necessarily in that it's going to be demolished or a fight that it's going to be retained, but how is it going to be rehabilitated? Things often lose their charm and distinctiveness when not done appropriately. So there's a real concern about that because this is world famous Hollywood Boulevard, and this is a contributor to the Hollywood Boulevard Historic District.
Right, good.
Can I ask a question? So, John, you're obviously really knowledgeable, and you've been doing this for a very long time. Can I just ask what your salary is for all this work that you do?
You know how many people out there give their time and their passion, and it makes them lose their hair, but they do it anyways. So you know we're all in this together with blood, sweat, and tears, and
That
no cash
yeah.
payments.
That
And
means
actually,
they can't fire you. It's wonderful. They
I actually
can't
will
fire
add
you.
a second thing to that. There's also another differentiation. There's a lot of people who volunteer, but there's also a lot of people who volunteer who do not profit in any other ancillary way,
Yeah.
meaning that I don't get preservation jobs. And there's actually, let me put this also in there. There's a lot of development professionals who volunteer their time in preservation who lose out on jobs because they've been tagged as preservation friendly, even though they work in the quote unquote developer world of evil developers. So it does go the full gamut. Just to also mention that new construction project at Hollywood and Wilcox that will be directly behind the Addy Building will run south all the way to the Mark Twain Hotel.
Oh
So
no.
the concern for the Mark impact on the Mark Twain Hotel, which is designated and historic, it's not a City of Los Angeles historic cultural monument, but it is eligible. It's a very interesting mixture of Spanish mission style. It's a funky, fun building. But the south side of the new construction 15-story tower is a flat wall. So what the Mark Twain's northern windows will look at is a flat wall. And actually, just a little more note on Hollywood, I love what they've done with the Mark Twain because
Yes.
currently AMDA, the American Conservatory Musical School, I'm not sure of the correct name, they use it as student housing. They also use just one block down the Hotel Gilbert on Wilcox as student housing. What an amazing way to retain our historic buildings that would have otherwise been demolished, but to adaptively reuse them and reuse them for what they originally were intended as housing and for the students of Hollywood. I mean, that's just, it's kind of fun.
And college housing is so overpriced, it's probably in the ballpark of what you can do with one of those illegal Airbnbs, and which you can't do anymore. So I think it's wonderful. It's a win-win for everybody.
Okay, we're going to leave, but I just want to close by saying that the Mark Twain Hotel and the Gilbert Hotel on Wilcox, just another block south, these define single room occupancy flop house hotels
Hotels.
in Hollywood for me in the 1980s. This is my childhood. These are just such great flop houses, and there's so much character to them, and we have to be very good stewards of these two
Oh, honey,
buildings.
I wouldn't walk anywhere near there. The closer you got to Santa Monica Boulevard, the heavier things got, especially at night. And the boys were out, and they were just so poorly behaved and weird and unpredictable. That was wonderful. I learned so much in Hollywood when my mother thought I was home and I wasn't.
Good. Okay. John, let's hopscotch over to down to Sunset Boulevard. Let's land at Sunset in Cahuenga. Sunset and Argyle.
That works too.
Let's talk about the Earl Carroll Theater.
Sure,
Just
yeah. There's
briefly?
just
Yeah, just I
yeah, just an update. So the
Yeah.
update on the there's been a lot of
What what
misinformation
um
that the
what
Earl,
what
go ahead.
what 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 I'm sorry. What is the Earl Carroll Theater? What is it? For people that
Ah,
don't know. Like, what is
there you
it?
go. So 6230 Sunset Boulevard, so one block east of Sunset and Vine, across the street from the Hollywood Palladium, is the Earl Carroll Theater, formerly Nickelodeon Studios on Sunset. It's got a great history, but the real quick one is built in 1938 as a tremendous palace of neon. Neon was actually just new, and Los Angeles was one of the epicenters of how neon was exploding. And they were testing out new colors of neon and new features at the Earl Carroll when it opened in 1938. So what the misinformation is Hollywood Heritage and other organizations such as Los Angeles Historic Theater Foundation and Art Deco Society created a campaign of preservation 2014 to 2016, landmarked the theater, and also gained some restoration work. Now, come to 2020, Essex Property Development is implementing that starting to implement that restoration work, which will be a restoration of the Sunset Boulevard lighting design, including the neon vertical stripes and the portraiture of Beryl Wallace. The misinformation is that in the news blogs and stories was that the theater was being restored. And there's a big difference between rehabilitation, restoration, etc. So there is no plans for restoration of the interior of the theater, although great news is that the tenant who is now in the theater was originally proposed by Essex Development to be converted to creative office space. So we would have lost this beautiful gem. We would have had its exterior, but we would have lost this beautiful venue that has hosted music and other exciting events for the decades. A tenant has moved in who wants to restore it to its former glory as the Earl Theater Entertainment Complex. And so we have really positive energy and high hopes for the tenant to be able to do that. And we believe that the tenant will want to restore the interior in some form or fashion with whatever capabilities they will be. But at least it's going to be a tenant that is a good steward, someone that respects what the history is of the theater.
Perfect. Kim, is there anything you'd like to add about the history of this sunset facade of the Earl Carroll with the neon of Beryl or the footprints
Well,
or?
it's an interesting problem because depending on how old you are and if you're interested in old Hollywood or if you're interested in rock and roll history, this is a building that has had different lives and different meanings for a lot of people. And I'm just really curious to see if you restore it to Earl Carroll, which, had a pretty limited lifespan. And although we have wonderful postcards of it and it was kind of legendary in its day, it's a little unfamiliar. So I think it's going to be a really cool opportunity for interpretation and perhaps giving a building a chance to have perhaps some virtual life as a story that is maybe you stand in front of it and you click through an app and you see the different facades and you read the different histories and then you go inside and hopefully it'll be an Art Deco neon palace where, golly, I hope one day groups of people will be able to go into buildings together and be entertained. I don't know what life will
I
be
have a
like without that.
counterpoint for you. I have a counterpoint for you, Kim.
Yes?
I often thought, as you, that it's rock and roll history. It was the club hullabaloo. It was the Aquarius for Hair. It was the club kaleidoscope. The
Yeah.
Doors double album, Live at the Aquarius. So there's all this amazing. Janis Joplin had a two-night gig with Big Brother and the Holding Company. There's
Emmett
all this.
Rose played there with the Palace Guard. That's a big deal to me. Maybe not to you. I
Keely
don't know.
Smith and Lou
Yeah.
Pluma, Sammy Davis, all kinds of different acts throughout the eras played there. When I was orchestrating the preservation campaign, I was surprised to learn how much there was love and remembrance for the Earl Carroll era. Now, maybe it's not a love for the actual entertainment that went on there, But it is a definite Los Angeles love for the exterior of that building. Not only is the Beryl Wallace neon portraiture recreated on Universal City Walk and has been there for 10 years or so, but the Museum of Neon has it on loan there, but that Beryl Wallace portraiture is also recreated at the Bob Baker Marionette Theater during their Hollywood puppet review. Part of the numbers is classic neon Hollywood signs. And one of those signs was, surprisingly to me, to be the Beryl Wallace portraiture from the Earl Carroll Theater. So somehow that imagery on the exterior of the building has been ingrained into Los Angelinos of every generation. I do agree that I find the rock and roll history more exciting, but maybe this is a doorway for people to learn about that rock and roll history.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that having seen how people interacted with that whiskey advertising neon sign that was installed for a while at Grand Central Market, and it just became the number one selfie station in downtown, and people would stand in front of it and they weren't even thinking about the fact that they were advertising whiskey. They just loved all of the motifs and getting themselves in the shot. Neon's sexy. You can smell it. You can hear it. It makes you look beautiful. And I think everyone's going to want to be photographed with that neon, and it's just going to become once again a landmark. People are going to fall in love and they're going to want to know what the story is. And that's your job, kiddo. You got to tell that story.
Okay, John, stop. We're going to keep moving. Kim, stay in focus. We're on Sunset Boulevard. We're talking about rock and roll music. I want you to tell us how Amoeba Music killed the record store in Hollywood.
All right. Well, you know, it was just sad because I was a fan of Amoeba. I used to shop up in the Bay Area stores, and then I heard they were coming to Hollywood.
Where was the Amoeba Music record store on Sunset? It was at Cahuenga, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's right in the heart of Hollywood. Okay. And, you know, they announced where they were opening and how big they were going to be, and everybody, you know, got excited, and they knew that they were saving up really good merch to, you know, and they made it like an Easter egg hunt. I mean, they were promoting the fact that when you come in on that first day, you better line up because we're going to put rarities in the 25-cent bins. And everybody I knew was lined up there. I was there. And then I went to my favorite record store, Aaron's, down on Highland. And everybody at Aaron's was looking really green around the gills. And everyone was saying, I don't know if we're going to make it. This is really close and really bad. And it's one thing to have a neighborhood of little record stores, like Hollywood used to have little bookstores where people come in and they wander from place to place. But it's another thing to build basically the Amazon.com of record stores around the corner from Aaron's. And so, you know, I've always just had kind of a bad feeling about it because they were not Angelinos and they obviously were very well capitalized and they bought their building and then they sold their building. And it's just been kind of sad. I know people like the store and a whole generation has grown up in it, but I think it was kind of a dickish thing to do, to quote Nathan Marsak, to move where they moved. And I think there were other places they could have been that would have allowed a little room for a record district to breathe. And they didn't have to be that big. That's what they did. And now they're having trouble and they've got their GoFundMe.
So John, do you want to talk about how tone deaf Amoeba Music's GoFundMe campaign is?
I really do, because it does connect to the development world. You know, Amoeba had a lot of PR going around, misinformation. I'm not saying they're responsible for it, but there was a lot of misinformation like, oh, sad, oh, woe is me. Amoeba is being kicked out of their property and having to leave Hollywood. This is over the course of 2 years ago when they were selling their property. So indeed, they owned their property and they made a choice to sell their property for $34 million. So I am not crying that Amoeba was leaving that location. It's not a historic building. There's nothing historic about it. And they sold out the community. It was one of my... Let's not forget
the murals. The murals are good.
I wasn't around in Hollywood for the record stores that Kim is describing. It sounds like it's the same situation that Hollywood Boulevard was known for bookstores, and those were slowly kicked out. So it might have been. So I guess it was known for little record shops as well.
Well, there were a bunch down on Melrose, and then, you know, they didn't last that as long as Aaron's did. But Aaron's, you know, was very successful for what it was, which was a new and used collector's store, which got all the new releases and carried my zine. and they were great people, and you know, people loved them. It was a crappy record store where you get some attitude and get what you were looking for. I loved it.
For me, moving here in 2011 to Hollywood, Amoeba was a great thing. It was another neighbor, like a Larry Edmonds. I know it's different, and we're connecting them possibly in a GoFundMe campaign connection. But Amoeba for me was, I totally understand your point that you've just made, and I would agree with it. But not knowing any of that, Amoeba was kind of a cool neighborhood serving business. I know it was large, but it was something that I could walk to, like Iguana Vintage Clothing at Hollywood Boulevard and Vine, or at Larry Edmonds, or the American Cinematheque. Amoeba was something else in Hollywood that both a tourist and a local neighborhood person could enjoy. Yes, I agree with you also that their move is planned to, I believe it's 6200 Hollywood Boulevard. It's Hollywood Boulevard in Argyle. It's in a new residential and commercial complex. I think they could have kept a lot of their street cred if they would have taken over one of the decaying buildings on Hollywood Boulevard. There's a lot of buildings on Hollywood Boulevard that are shuttered or in bad condition or just housing a lot of stuff that's not necessarily conducive to revitalizing the boulevard, you know, junkie shops. It would have been nice if Amoeba moved into a space and that had character to it and did a little revitalization.
Perfect. And just to wrap this up, I just explicitly want your opinion on the optics of their recently started GoFundMe campaign, comparing and contrasting to Larry Edmonds, who actually needs the money.
Yes, of course. It's a legacy. Larry Edmonds is a legacy business. It's a legacy business, and it's important to Los Angeles in many different forms. And a single owner, I mean, it's so much the definition of what a GoFundMe campaign is. And another one that is just as important as a neighborhood-serving location, but that also serves everyone else, is Arena Cine Lounge.
Yes.
They're a small place that's just one block west of Amoeba Records, and that's Christian Mioli. And for, I guess, since 2017, he's had his little independent screen there that he plays things that you cannot see anywhere else. And by the way, that was an Academy-approved theater. And so I know he had to invest a lot of money to make it an Academy-approved theater. So I wonder how the Academy changing those rules will affect his platform of business, because it used to cater to people having to do the one-week releases for Academy. But anyways, Arena Cine Lounge has to have a GoFundMe campaign now too. And I find it offensive that as part of the Amoeba campaign for GoFundMe, yes, of course, it talks about having to pay their 400 employees. And like, I want their 400 employees to be paid, but they just made a $34 million profit on a development property. So when they insert the line in their GoFundMe campaign of they need assistance, financial assistance in helping them move to their new Hollywood location, how much more offensive can you get? They made $34 million to make that move. Why would they ask the private citizen to GoFundMe? They could have left that comment out, and I might have been somewhat supportive. But not really. Arena Cine Lounge, Larry Edmonds, that's where you ought to put your money.
Okay, and I'm just going to leave us with this. 400 employees and a giant record store filled with merch. Why aren't you selling online? Why don't you put your people to work actually making money with all your merchandise? It's just bizarre to me. I mean, there are people who, you know, Jeff is just sitting in the bookstore packing things up that people call him. He doesn't have an online website to sell all his stuff. He's desperately trying to make it work. It just makes me sad because I think that people put a lot of hope and trust in what seems like the big guys. And at the end of the day, it's really, really hard to run a business, and it's really hard to look after hundreds of people. And at a certain point, you have to just step aside and say, you know what, I created something great here. And maybe I'm not good enough at managing to make this sustainable. And there are people who, you know, you can hire people whose job it is not to suck all of the life and all the resources out of a business, but just to actually fine tune it and make it work better. And that's what I'd like to hear that they're planning on doing with the GoFundMe, more than just not putting people on the unemployment rolls, because, hey, that money's there. As a matter of fact, some people are making more money on unemployment than they did at their jobs. Thank God.
Okay. We're gonna get ourselves to Hollywood and Vine, and we're gonna get in the next couple of minutes to Yucca and Argyll, just north, just to the north of it. So, John, very quickly, we're just north on Vine Street above Hollywood Boulevard. I want you to talk about the Hollywood Center project and the Lexington.
You got it. So,
okay, yeah.
If we're
very quickly, yeah.
Intersection of Hollywood and Vine, the northeast corner of Hollywood and Vine is the Equitable Building. Mm-hmm. Just north of that is a one-story building. It's an original building. It was once a DuPars. It's been many things. I think it was recently a restaurant called Lexington. Anyways, the entitlements are already approved. It is to be demolished, and the Citizen M Hotel is to rise. These are one of these prefab modular hotels. One has already completed construction downtown, and so another one of these style of Citizen M modular hotels is slated to demolish the building north of the Equitable Building and build a hotel adjacent. Now, go one parcel up from that new construction is the former Millennium Project, now titled the Hollywood Center Project.
Right.
And that's where they will build their largest tower, right next to the Capitol Records building. So now what you have on the east street-facing side of Vine Street, right above Hollywood Boulevard, you will now have a lineup of buildings. The Equitable, the new Citizen M Hotel, the new Hollywood Center Skyrise.
Millennium.
In Millennium.
They don't want you to call it Millennium because the San Francisco project started tilting, and it's one of the biggest disasters in engineering history. It was a very, very expensive condo building, and everyone is suing because they screwed it up, and this giant building is probably going to topple into the bay.
Another important factor that's going on, we just spoke about the Addy building at Hollywood and Wilcox and that 15-story development. That draft environmental impact report, and also the draft environmental impact report for former Millennium, now Hollywood Center, and also another project we're going to talk about one block over, the 6220 Yucca project. All three of those draft environmental impact reports are all due within 30 days of each other during this pandemic. So city planning is moving full ahead with ginormous projects, and the public is having limited access or even knowledge or even aware. And to end it quickly on the former Millennium Hollywood Center project, there was a campaign going around trying to extend the comment period so that people would have more time, considering of the pandemic, to make their comments about this $1 billion in four buildings encompassing two lots surrounding the Capitol Records building. And that request for extension of the comment period was denied by the city planning. Attorney Robert Silverstein is fighting that currently.
Well, come on, John. I mean, you know, it's a matter of time until the federal government actually brings the hammer down and takes people away in handcuffs. There are people in city planning who are implicated in this. There are plenty of council members. There's people at the county. There's all sorts of land use lobbyists and attorneys. They're going to clean house, and they want to get all these projects approved because, you know, their kids still need to go to college and to medical school, and their third wives expect support for their twins. And I mean, what kind of monster are you who wants to stop this project?
Don't answer that question.
Yeah,
John,
don't even answer it.
Okay, John, I need to get us to Yucca and Argyll.
I'll get you there, but I have one more last comment.
Please.
Yeah, go ahead.
Go.
One of the four buildings of the Millennium Project no one's talking about will rise north of the Knickerbocker Hotel, and it will rise tall enough to block the view of the historic Knickerbocker neon sign when you're traveling on the 101 freeway. Why is that important? Because when you're traveling northbound on the 101 coming into Hollywood, the Kimpton Hotel, which was built in the last couple of years, now blocks the view of Capitol Records. So if you're traveling northbound on 101 from downtown Los Angeles, you cannot see the Capitol Record buildings when you swoop into Hollywood. So now imagine that same effect when you're coming now southbound. You come through the Cahuenga Pass. You come out of the Cahuenga Pass into the view of Hollywood, and you want to see the iconic skyline of Capitol Records, and the Knickerbocker is part of that iconic skyline because the neon sign only points in that direction towards the Cahuenga Pass and towards the freeway. It is not meant to be viewed from the south. So if you're building a building right in front of it, blocking it from its original view, I know I'm kind of sounding a little bit too into the details, but I don't think we need to lose a sign being blocked. And if anyone wants to know the pain of that, go to the intersection of Hollywood and Vine to the historic Plaza Hotel. The Plaza Hotel has a fully restored and lit, beautiful neon rooftop sign that is completely obscured from view by modern billboards. And so here we have kind of a similar situation. We're going to allow another project or another billboard, whatever you want to call it, to block something that's historic when just a little bit of planning will help prevent that. And of course, that is comments that I've made to the Hollywood Center team, but we'll see if those were listened to.
Boy, I bet they wish they could fire you.
They can't
They
fire.
can't
They can't
fire.
fire him.
Moving to Yucca
John, we
and
talked.
Argyle.
Yeah. Look. Yes. Let me. Okay. Help me. We talked about this yesterday briefly. If you're standing in the overgrown, abandoned lot, just on the east side of the street, just south of Yucca and Ivar, on
So
Ivar.
if you walk south of the Capitol Records building through their parking lot and across the block, and you're actually walking on top of their legendary echo chambers, which are potentially going to be destroyed by this project made by people who don't even know how to build a high rise that doesn't tilt and fall into the bay. You walk through the block, you get to the adjacent block on the east side, and there is a beautiful secret garden behind a chain link fence.
So I want you to talk about green space. I want you to talk about the impact of these proposed buildings, which are in their draft EIR stage, on this abandoned garden and what it is, and then we'll get to the building just above it, the Yucca Ivar Apartments, and all of that property development.
Historic cultural monument, Little Hollywood, Little Country Church on Argyle is a little green oasis amidst a urban concrete jungle. Right now, to the south of it was the new 6200 Boulevard development, so it's blocked in there. The Millennium Hollywood Center Project Towers will block it on its west side. And now the 6220 Yucca Project will be on its north side, which is the demolition of 1940s courtyard style apartment buildings, two of them, and also a residential house. That area is called the Vista Del Mar Historic District. Now, the Little Country Church property is important. Why is, but there's no church there, John. Well, it burned down in 2007. But originally, that property was the front yard of the Bartlett Estate. So there was a mansion there, and it's very famous. We don't need to get into it, but it was the Bartlett Estate. And so now in Hollywood, there is only two extant landscapes. Excuse me, pardon me, three. I'll get you the third one. Extant landscapes of when pre-film industry of when Hollywood was a summering community of mansions and great gardens and churches. So we have Yamashiro, which is a historic district and was known for its hillside gardens. We have Wattles Garden, which is a historic landscape. And the Little Country Church, those palm trees and all of those, the foliage, that was from the Bartlett Estate. And so that's the remnants of his estate. So the only thing that's left is Wattles Mansion and the front yard of the Bartlett Estate, which is Little Country Church. Why is it threatened? It's because you're going to enclose it with all these skyscrapers. So I say this. You have three projects that have draft environmental impact reports coming due all relatively at the same time, three sets of project towers surrounding it. Why would all three companies not have to do a community benefit where they purchase the Little Country Church property and it's developed as a pocket park for the community? And they, of course, everyone says, the homeless will take it over. The homeless will take it over. Those three companies can provide in perpetuity security and maintenance for this little pocket park. We have no, the heat index is rising. We have no trees. We have no nothing. And here we have a historic cultural monument. The landscape is part of the church burned down, but the landscape is part of the historic cultural monument. So we're saving all kinds of things all at once and giving a community amenity.
Perfect. Let me, Kim, go.
All right. Well, Wattles is important to me, John, because I really am from Hollywood. But when I was very little, we lived in Venice, and sometimes my dad came into town. and he was in charge of me. And we went and visited my godfather, Nate, whose job it was to be the caretaker of the Waddles Mansion. And this must have been 1970. It was before we got into the bread van and moved up to up the coast to like live at Big Sur and have strange adventures.
Were you almost drowned?
Well, yeah, I almost drowned there. Got some superpowers. But the point is, I was a very...
Quack.
Stop quacking. I was a very, very brainy child, and I have a lot of extremely early memories. So I remember being on the porch of the Waddles Mansion, looking out at Hollywood, and being just a chatterbox, and my dad wanting to hang out with Nate, and Nate being like, how are you going to shut that kid up? And they decided that the thing to do was to put beer in my bottle. And so there I was, slurping down my first taste of beer at the Waddles Mansion. And I was very, very happy. And I shut up and took a nap. And my mom never knew what happened. And here we are.
I love it.
I like Hollywood landscapes.
I want to just wrap up our discussion of Little Community Church of Hollywood by telling this anecdote, because I figured it out. I was on the phone with you, John, when this happened. I went to the Office of Historic Resources to pull the 600-plus page historic cultural monument application for Little Church of Hollywood, and was horrified. Sort of wonderment filled me as I saw it was so thick, and then I realized, no, 95% of the 600-plus pages are just reports from the fire department to the CHC, the Cultural Heritage Commission, about what to do with all of this.
Beginning with the story about how the person who owned it was trying to put in a kitchen so they could have weddings there, and it was completely illegal and much bigger than it was supposed to be. And in the course of putting this completely unsuitable wiring on the property, they managed to burn the church down because the city of Los Angeles takes such good care of landmarks.
So I'm calling you, John, and I'm saying, oh, this is amazing. It's 600 pages.
We're going to learn so much.
And I'm getting really confused because I know what goes into what the structure of an historic cultural monument application is, and the section where all the heavy lifting happens.
The history.
The essay that says, this is why this is important. These are all the reasons. These are all the architects. These are all the styles. These are all the movements, et cetera, et cetera. It's currently called Section 7B. Section 7B was missing. And it's supposed to be like the first 20 pages. And I'm like looking through the first 30 pages and I can't find.
And you're looking through the original in a corner of the office with your giant file folder next to you. And potentially if something were to disappear, who would know? Golly. And so, who's interested in these documents? Developers? Golly. Lawyers? Land use consultants? Lobbyists?
So I have to go through all 600 pages because I'm thinking, oh, they like someone put it back in the wrong place. And so this 10 to 15 page document, which codifies why this is an historic cultural monument, is lost in there, but I'm going to find it and put it back in place. And it doesn't exist. And as I'm putting all the pages back together and I'm heartbroken, Lambert Giesinger walks by, the preservation architect for the city of Los Angeles. And I say, hey, Lambert, did you know that the section 7B, the section about historical context, did you know it's missing from Little Community Church of Hollywood? And he said, oh, you figured that out, huh? And I said, where is it? And he said, I don't know.
Maybe we left it on top of the file cabinet.
He
didn't say that,
Kim. He said, I don't know. No one knows where it is. So there's no way to protect this monument, theoretically, because they've lost the essay.
Oh, that's Robert Silverstein, what he thinks. You can't just lose this stuff. That's not okay.
I am not a conspiracy person, but the thing about it is no, everyone acts like they don't know about the little country church property. And I'm not talking about the fire or whatever, but just like as if there's not this huge oasis gem just sitting there. Yeah. I personally have had one ongoing FaceTime since 2011 with Councilmember LaBange, Councilmember Mitch O'Farrell three times. Who else am I? Oh, former Councilmember Wu. One-on-one FaceTime with the lead head of Millennium Partners back in 2012. I was granted a one-on-one FaceTime with him to pitch him buying the Little Country Church property as an amenity for his buildings. He already fully knew about it. He had already tried to buy it himself. I also had the same conversation with another developer. So the idea that and repeated developers all had their own personal stories about how they couldn't get a hold of this property. So I'm not lending myself to conspiracy theories, but there's something going on when people who are in charge of not exaggerated $1 billion projects that are within 500 feet, multiple projects that are within 500 feet of that location, all know about the little country church, but no one can seem to possibly figure out a way to convert it to a pocket park.
Okay,
I'm sorry. Elvis has left the building.
Okay. We're
Hey, it's still there.
Okay, we did it. We've gotten ourselves to Yucca and Argyle. We're at the southeast corner, 622 Yucca.
You mean we're going to the most interesting part of this entire conversation?
Yes. We are finally have arrived at John Walsh's, God rest his soul, John Walsh's former apartment building for 35 years. These beautiful immediate pre-war courtyard apartments, which line...
They're post-war, aren't they?
Oh, that's right. They're immediate post-war. Yeah. Sorry.
But they're early.
They line Yucca on the south side
pastel
of the street.
Pastel-colored, charming.
Just east of Ivar. So, John Holt, take a breath. Take a breath. Kim, I want you to tell us who John Walsh is.
When we started going to City Hall and trying to save things, there was this guy who we, you know, couldn't miss because he was a shaggy weirdo. And he typically would be wearing a very loud polyester sport coat.
Plaid.
Clearly from about 1976, and often an American flag tie. And he was extremely articulate and informed and very pissed off about Hollywood. But he was also, kind of losing his mind by drips and drops. And he was an older dude. We never really connected with him because we were doing our thing and he was doing his, but we certainly knew who he was. And I knew his name because he was very prominent in City Hall. And I learned from looking into him that he had been the person who had this extraordinary line of tips coming out of Metro when my beloved Hollywood was nearly destroyed by the Red Line coming through Hollywood Boulevard. And much like the Millennium in San Francisco tipping over and nearly falling into the sea, the guys who were digging under the street were doing the wrong things. And John was getting all these tips warning that what would happen. And that was that Hollywood Boulevard would collapse
into the tunnel. This was in the early 1990s when this was happening.
And he wasn't a land use professional, and he wasn't even particularly a preservationist. He was just a guy who had moved to Hollywood, was very interested in the politics of humor. He got a gig as a young man writing gags. He listened to every topical comedian. He read everything. He lived in Hollywood. He cared a lot. And when he made it clear that he did care, he made a lot of friends in the underground and the independent press, and then eventually people in city planning and a Metro. And he became, much as we became, the conduit for the story about what was happening at the Egyptian Theater at a much smaller scale. He became the person who stood up and did this performative protest while blowing the whistle on what was this massive corrupt scam that caused a great deal of harm to Hollywood and hurt the small businesses and set us back many, many years in terms of the revival of this neighborhood. And so John, I understand where it happens because he was taking on very powerful people. He was standing in the way of extremely large projects. And eventually he started to feel like he was under personal assault. I'm sure he was. And he didn't want to go out much anymore. And he wasn't really feeling safe. And so when he became ill, he decided to just kind of stay home and look after himself. And he ended up dying in his apartment just to the north of your beautiful garden. And our friend Mickey.
This was last year.
Yeah. Our friend Mickey, who is old friends of his, knows that we're book people. And she was overwhelmed with cleaning his amazing two-bedroom, low-income apartment out and asked if we'd like to help and take some books. And we were happy to do so.
Perfect. Okay. So John Girodo, you're now on. Kim, thank you. That was a great introduction to John Walsh. If you love Hollywood, you love John Walsh because everything everyone loves about Hollywood, John Walsh, had something to do with, and John Giroudo. Case in point, Robert Noodleman and Hollywood Heritage. John Walsh helped Robert Noodleman tremendously with his research in understanding the architectural heritage and cultural heritage of Hollywood. So I want you to explain to us the role Robert Noodleman played as the representative for Hollywood Heritage in the 90s and early aughts. Go.
I'm going to do that. I'm going to explain Robert Noodleman, which I don't know much about, but I'm going to connect it back to John Walsh.
Yeah.
So Robert Noodleman, famous. Everyone seems to know who Robert Noodleman is in Hollywood. When I moved in 2011 and was looking at apartments, I was only looking at apartments in historic buildings. I would bring up the fact that I was associated with Hollywood Heritage. The first thing you say in Hollywood, if you see Hollywood Heritage, that is equivalent to Robert Noodleman. The lore goes, because it's before my time, but the lore goes, he had his hands in everything. We were speaking about the country church and trying to turn that into Pocket Park and the Millennium Project. The reason I had face-to-face time with Phil Ahrens, head of the billion-dollar Millennium Project, was because previously, before he died in 2007, Robert Noodleman had face-to-face time with Phil Ahrens trying to save the little country church. So it was the paving the way. Robert Noodleman paved the way for my style of interaction and preservation. I'm a filmmaker. I knew nothing about preservation. I moved to this town. I wanted to see it saved. I liked old things. I was self-taught. I became empowered by my colleagues at Hollywood Heritage to learn how to do this preservation movement. But it was because Robert Noodleman did it as a self-taught, boots on the ground type of passionate individual that I was more welcomed. My style was more welcomed. What I added to it that Robert Noodleman did, and which would not have been effective 2012 to 2018, Mr. Noodleman had his associates and partners, but he was often a lone wolf. And sometimes that can be a great thing. He single-handedly, well, not everyone's involved, but he had a great influence on saving the El Capitan Theater, et
Yes.
cetera. So when it comes around to the multi-billion-dollar development boom that was starting to happen in 2011 in Hollywood, that style of one-on-one, just your personal relationship with somebody, was no longer cutting it. Neighborhood councils were coming into play more powerfully with their planning and land use committees. And organizations like Hollywood Heritage, having a organized and established voice, were becoming more powerful. So it was more of an organizational voice that I was able to harness, as opposed to just being an individual like Robert Noodleman. So I don't know how much of the myth is combined with the reality, but everyone seems to have loved Mr. Noodleman, and all I know is that he paved the way for the ability to even have a grassroots type of preservation. There are, of course, my colleagues who are doing it the professional preservation way and achieving great strides by actually getting Hollywood Boulevard made a historic district and making things official. But Mr. Noodleman was quite successful in doing a boots on the ground style. It's mysterious how things happen. And just as his approach would not have worked during my approach no longer works. The neighborhood councils have been very disempowered in Hollywood, and developers have learned ways to get around their design review. Also, city government has made things like the TOC ordinance incentive program. I'm sorry, I called it an ordinance,
It's
and I'm
not
the
an
one.
ordinance. It's not
I'm
an
the one who
ordinance.
had the article about that it's not an ordinance. Excuse me, the TOC incentive program,
It's
which
a
allows
faux ordinance.
The incentive program, and there's other incentive programs that the state has allowed so that DE draft environmental impact reports can be rushed through, et cetera, et cetera. So no longer is the grassroots of gaining neighborhood council support, gaining organizational partners and community support, that's even waning in its style. And we're really having to rely on Mr. Silverstein and his lawsuits and big state decisions. I may have went off target, but I wanted to mention
No.
something about John Walsh. John Walsh, to me, I was not aware of his past background with the whistleblowing on the subway system and the transit and all his accomplishments, I was somebody who I admittedly judged him. I started going downtown circa 2012, and that was the start of what I think was possibly his decline. We were going downtown for the Hollywood Community Plan was being fought at City Hall. And John Walsh was very much of a performance artist, I later would learn. And that was one of his tactics. But to me, he appeared as the stereotyped crazy guy complaining at City Hall about everything. That's a bad analysis, but I'm trying to cut to the chase. So I would see Mr. Walsh almost weekly over the course of 2012 through 2018, commenting on everything under the sun at City Hall, not knowing all of his expertise and his past accomplishments, and also realizing that it was some type of style of performance art to get attention, to call attention to important issues. But yes, I still was uncomfortable with his often rude or abrasive style in public. Later, I had the opportunity, I was very blessed to have the opportunity to help clean out Mr. Walsh's apartment when he passed away. And I had an amazing connection to the man then. I discovered who he really was, and I felt bad about judging him, but I understood why it happened. Here was a guy who moved to Hollywood, first of all, very educated. I can't remember his university, but spent time in the Peace Corps in Ethiopia in the 60s. He went to Berkeley and was working at a free clinic in Berkeley. Then he moved to Hollywood to try to become a writer. He sold several episodes. He was part of the Writers Guild. He sold several episodes of some fun 80s television shows. He was wrote jokes for found letters from Steve Allen and others thanking him for his jokes that they had written for him. So he truly was a performance artist, truly did use humor. I do agree with Kim's analysis that as his health declined in the later years, I think some of the mixture of his performance art and his style of tactics started to, they became less precise, shall we say. But anyways, discovering the man of who he was, and he was a part-time teacher, so he educated kids. He was involved in all kinds of stuff, and he just took it upon himself on the Metro gig to start becoming the whistleblower and finding all his documents in the newspaper articles. This man was amazing. He really did. There was lives lost in the construction of the Metro. People died. Workers died. And he predicted those. I found the letters where he predicted those danger areas.
Right. I'm and he was told this by people on the inside who were desperately worried about the people who were under their command, but they didn't have the power.
I thank him for I'm interrupting you, Kim, because I'm so passionate about him.
I want to say something because I don't want to lose this, and then I want you to take off. Don't be done. The reason we don't know who John Walsh is because the independent and underground newspapers were gutted in Los Angeles. There was this bizarre New Times LA Weekly battle where whole archives of Los Angeles political coverage were legally erased from the internet. And these are things that weren't covered in the Los Angeles Times, which is as it is now and as it was then, you know, it was the mainstream pro-development paper. We've lost a story that we desperately needed about this golden thread of really bold, brave people who stood up and made change. And, you know, if we hadn't found in the apartment that great New Times cover story, which we scanned and put on our blog and we'll link to it, you know, there's plenty of people right now who wouldn't know who John Walsh is. And I want that corner to be John Walsh Square. And I don't want that beautiful apartment building, those two apartment buildings, to be torn down. And I want people to remember that Hollywood meant something once upon a time, and that people like him, who lived in the same apartment their whole life and worked their asses off for Los Angeles, not for their own benefit, but because they love this place. I want people to talk about him. I don't want people talking about these morons who build giant hotels and move billions of dollars in laundered money around and kick the homeless when they're down. Screw them. They're not Angelenos. These people are criminals. And John knew it. We found in that apartment the note that said, if anything happens to me, you look to Garcetti. And that note was in that apartment. I don't believe that Garcetti whacked him. But that's how he felt. And he did this because he loved Los Angeles.
John, hold on, Kim. I want you to end our discussion of John Walsh's apartment by telling us the most amazing album in the entire world you found.
Which one?
The one about the man who has the somnolent
episodes. Oh, yeah, I got the Dan McGregor record out of his stash. Okay. So he had, it's a two-bedroom apartment. So he's got this crummy little bed in one room, and he's got nothing but books in the living room and the dining room. And the closet is filled with all of his jokes and his baseball collection from when he was a kid. And then the other bedroom is comedy records. And he doesn't actually have record shelves. He's just stacked the records as you do against the wall when you're a college student, you know, but then he buys more records, so he stacks another stack on top of each stack that leans against the wall. So there's about
three stacks high.
So it's like 3,000 records. And I start going through them, and I thought I was going to, you know, really hit the jackpot. But then Mickey said, oh, you know, we got to send this stuff to a university. So I got what I got, and I got the Dion McGregor record. And Dion McGregor, he talks in his sleep. It's a famous record because Edward Gorey did the cover. But it's a famous record because Dion McGregor was this weird, arty, gay man in New York City who started narrating incredibly complicated, surrealistic dreams out loud. He was a person who literally spoke in his sleep, and his roommate started running a reel-to-reel, and these records came out. And this is one of the most famous weirdo records of all time. And, you know, I mean, obviously it's reissued on CD, but it's really special to me to have his copy. And I do. I have his copy. And it's a little bit magical. I got some pretty great books out of that place, too.
Thank you, Mickey.
Thanks, Mickey.
Okay, John, I want you to wrap it up with John Walsh, and then I want to wrap this up by you bringing us home with what is proposed at John Walsh's former residence for 35 plus years, 6220 Yucca. So let's just wrap up all these loose ends.
I guess I would wrap up my John Walsh comments with the spirit of the man, in the sense that out his apartment window, within feet, right across the street, was the newly built Kimpton Hotel.
Yeah.
Out the west side of the building was the newly built Modera Argyle. So here's a man going down every day during the years I'm living here, 2011 to 2018, I'm working on this stuff, and he's going down City Hall fighting it. Little do I know, out feet out his window is massive construction. And does this man complain about it? No. It's kind of like it's just a lot of spirit. I'm not trying to whitewash him. He again, was very abrasive and often unacceptable in his behavior in the later years in public. But I learned my lessons about judging people when I got to go inside his apartment and learned about who he was and where this was coming from. And then so jealous that he got to sell screenplays and then work on preservation, whereas I haven't sold my screenplay yet. So maybe I'm going to do the reverse. Thank you, John Walsh, for showing me the path. I'll now start working on my screenplays and getting back to that. What's planned for the property is a high-rise tower. I think it's three buildings total. So it will replace the two courtyard apartments, post-war courtyard apartments that are really nice. I mean, they're not luxury nice, but they're well-kept, and it's a nice place to live.
They're fucking awesome. They're really, we have photos.
Be demolished, and then it backs up again onto the Vista Del Mar Historic District, which is a little tiny street that has about seven little bungalows on it or so. Yeah. Some of them are in better condition than others, but this project will eliminate one of those houses. And so the concern there is, when you start eliminating contributors to a little historic district, and the district is only composed of, you know, half a dozen to a dozen buildings, you really impair it. You also impair it by putting a 15 or more story building right in it. Sorry, that was kind of not the fireworks ending you needed.
No.
I'm going to equate it to something that I think that we all need to think about, because we have to take really good care of ourselves, especially now when we can't go and get our teeth cleaned. You know, you get a sore tooth, and you want to save that tooth, because if you lose a tooth in an important part of your mouth, the dentist is going to want to take more out, and eventually you're going to end up with nothing that's original. So you got to protect those old teeth, you got to protect those old houses, you got to protect those old vistas and landscapes, because otherwise you're going to look like everywhere else in the world, and Hollywood is not like anywhere else in the world, and that's why you're here, And that's why I had my first beer there. And that's why Richard wrote the Raymond Chandler tour. And that's why we're going to get John Walsh Square once these crooks are out of office. And that's kind of where we're going to end it, because John Walsh is listening. And I think that he, you know, he was never nice to any of us, but I think he loves us in his way.
Oh, absolutely. So everyone go watch John Ford's film, The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance. And that's my closing thought on The Legend of Hollywood. Kim, do you want to, we've been talking for well over an hour. Is there anything in general we've missed that you just want to put on the table as a closing thought? And then we'll give it to John to wrap us up.
Yeah, this is actually a Robert Noodleman anecdote, but it's really a John Giroto anecdote. And you're going to be embarrassed by this, John, but when we first started doing preservation work, we got involved. We didn't actually write the nomination, but we were very much the spokespeople and the advocates for landmarking Charles Bukowski's bungalow on DeLongpre in East Hollywood. And that was a situation where property owners were advertising it on Craigslist as a teardown right before the bubble burst. And in defense of the possible landmarking, which was really moving forward very well, Lauren Everett wrote the landmarking nomination. The property owners hired an attorney who started telling the press that Charles Bukowski was a well-known Nazi. And this became international headlines because Charles Bukowski had apparently said at Cantor's at 4 a.m. to a friend who was kind of an asshole, "Turn on the gas," which is a stupid thing to say that he may or may not have said. It hardly means he's a Nazi. So there we are. We're waiting to give testimony. There's a full room. We're hearing really great stuff from the commissioners about how much they like Charles Bukowski and how confessional he was. And if he was really a Nazi, they'd know it. And telling the landlords how stupid they were not to capitalize on owning Bukowski's bungalow. And then Superman walked in.
Yep.
Superman, with this dumpy, bald-headed dude who everybody looked at and paid enormous respect to. And Robert Noodleman said, "I'm Robert Noodleman, and I'm here representing Hollywood Heritage, and I think this is a wonderful idea for a cultural landmark, and I certainly hope you'll vote for it." And we looked at him, we're like, "We didn't know you were coming." And he just smiled his little smile and got in his tiny car and drove to Arizona to visit his dad and dropped dead. And I think a lot about what he did and how he just pushed it just a little farther. I mean, I think the landmark was happening. But yeah, having him sprinkle fairy dust on it, everybody was listening to him. And I think when you walk into a project, people know your reputation. You have saved places that were in such peril, and you've done it through enormous amounts of work, emotional intelligence, creativity, and a shocking ability to connect with some of the most loathsome people alive, which my husband shares. And sometimes we sit down with these lobbyists and land use people, and they really are charming, and I do want to, you know, push them off a cliff, but at the same time, I kind of enjoy talking with them, and they say things to us like, you know, whatever else it is, we're on opposite sides, but there's always mutual respect, and it's always a pleasure to talk to you. And I think that the preservationists and the developers, when they see you coming, that's what's going on, because you're a straight shooter, you're coming from the side of the angels, your arguments are real, and just like Mr. Noodleman, as you call him, you're changing the world one step at a time, and I really respect you for that. And so you've got a little cape on too, just like he did.
John, wow. You don't actually have to say anything, because I know you're just beet red. So why don't you just, is there anything you want us to think about Hollywood as we sign off? Is there just one closing, Kim, that was beautiful, by the way. It just, I'm trying to get John to talk, because I know he's really embarrassed.
I think that the spirit that Kim just expressed is what's important. Is you don't need a background in this. Anyone, I hate saying it, anyone can do it, but you really can. And I think the key for my success, everything I accomplished was because I had the support and partnership of colleagues, development professionals, architects, knowledgeable historians, etc. And I do feel like I'm a straight shooter, and I do feel like people will do the right thing when everyone is engaged in somewhat of a team effort. Anyways, I will say one thing about the Robert Noodleman connection. I am very humbled by it, but there's a gentleman that your listeners will probably know, Mark Wanamaker.
Oh, yeah.
who's making incredible Bison Archives, of course, but many other things. Former president of Hollywood Heritage, good friend of Robert Noodleman and partner with Robert Noodleman in many things. Mark is a gift to the Hollywood community and the Los Angeles community. But Mark was one of the people, Mark Wanamaker was one of the people that empowered me when I first started. I was just a filmmaker, a know-nothing, but he trusted my passion and my honesty, and so he would support me, like other colleagues that will go unnamed, because we don't want to name everybody, but he would give me that support and would often say to me, and this is what makes you trip, is like, you're keeping Robert's legacy alive.
Yeah.
When Robert tried to get the little country church, I jumped in and tried to continue that project for him, etc. All right, exciting stuff, guys. We're all doing it. We're all doing it. There's so many people out there. There's so many people that are doing it. There's so many neighborhoods, so many individuals I've met over 9 years. They may have only participated in preservation one time. One time is enough. They saved something, small or large. Come on, guys. That's exciting stuff.
I told Nita Lelleveld of the LA Times when she tweeted about the 750 Edinburgh bungalow, which she wrote that great piece about, and a developer actually went into court to fight the owners and said, you're not allowed to not sell this building. That's the agreement is if somebody comes along and wants to preserve it and is paying your inflated price, you got to sell it. I said, Nita, this building is now yours. It's your responsibility. You're stuck with it. And she was kind of excited by that. I said, just like Angel's Flight is ours, because we fought for that one. We all fight for things.
Angel's Flight, Kim, just as an aside, you save buildings. We saved, it helped to save Angel's Flight. Angel's Flight saved us. Like, you don't fucking
one day we'll
know.
Tell that story. Okay, forget
like,
it.
No one knows how Angel's Flight saved us.
That'll
so,
be a good story. Maybe that'll be your first screenplay.
What,
now, John.
What goes around comes
what
around.
What goes around comes around. John, you're a Hollywood native. You walk around Hollywood. Right now, Los Angeles is closed. We're all under this pandemic alert. You can obviously get takeout food. There's certain things you can do. When Los Angeles opens up again, in a perfect world where all of these independent businesses that you have patronized for years and that you love are still around and they've all gotten, you know, all the unemployment benefits they've needed and their rent has been frozen and mortgage has been halted and whatever it takes to keep Los Angeles frozen in amber so we can actually get Hollywood back. I want you to tell me, it's 7 o'clock at night, you're walking out the door. What are you going to do? Tell me three things you can't wait to do again.
Oh, wow. I've got no answer for you, Kim, because I'm enjoying walking around now. Practicing social distancing and wearing my mask. But Hollywood is so clean and quiet right now. I would have thought that the transient community would have taken over, but they're being respectful. They're having a hard time of it during COVID-19, obviously. The city is not really providing so many services like these claimed water sanitization and portable toilets. But I'm enjoying, what am I wanting to see? I wish it could remain how it is now, less traffic and, you know, everything everyone else is talking about, right? People have learned to live a little bit easier on the urban structure.
That's actually a wonderful answer. I love that.
Okay, good. John Girodo, I want to thank you for your time tonight. I want to thank you for your participation in being a great Angelino and a great preservationist and just a great friend. And we'll
and
have
I
you
want
back.
To thank you guys for all the things that the public does not know. They know about all your major campaigns, whether it be LACMA or Angel's Flight or Metropolitan Water District, et cetera, but I don't think the public is aware of how many individuals reach out to you on a weekly basis trying to connect them with resources to save what's important to them. Maybe it's a mural, like the AIDS mural Blue yep. Moon trilogy that Kim and Richard assisted in saving by channeling their resources and support. Thank you, Kim and Richard, for all that you do in privately helping people and giving them the respect that they're important when they reach out to ask for help for something. You don't demean them or belittle them by saying, well, this is not important because no one else is taking it important. You instantly use your contacts and resources discreetly to enable people. Bye-bye. Have a good COVID-19.
What goes around comes around, my friend.
Hey, man, people who are in love with Los Angeles, there aren't enough of them. And you really have to blow on that flame because I want there to be more and I want them to feel empowered and I want them to stick around. And if it means we have to chase all the speculators out and throw half of city council into prison so that the John Walshes of the world can have that extra bedroom for their records, which are stored completely inappropriately, then we're just going to have to do that.
Okay, John, thank you. Kim, thank you. Everyone listening at home, I'm going to remind you, stay at home. Wash your hands. Remain calm.
Cover your nose. I know it's hard to keep it covered, but make sure the nose cover works.
And remember,
You can't eat the sunshine, baby. You really can't. Great episode.